The headlines. Iran's leader officially endorses Ebrahim Raisi as the 8th president of the Islamic Republic. Iran's incoming president Ebrahim Raisi pledges to lift U.S. sanctions on the country and improve the people's living conditions. Also the headlines, China's Wuhan will test its entire population for COVID-19 after the city where the coronavirus first emerged reported its first local infections in more than a year. Thanks for joining us. Iran's Islamic Revolution leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has endorsed Ebrahim Raisi as the country's new president in a ceremony in Tehran. In a mandate read out during the ceremony, the leader said the new president should work to remove obstacles to production and to strengthen the national currency. Later, Ayatollah Khamenei thanked people for their turnout in the June presidential election, despite the enemy's propaganda to persuade them to sanction the vote. The leader called on the new president to stay true to his election pledges, including efforts to address economic problems and fight corruption. Ayatollah Khamenei also said that the new president should move quickly to form his cabinet. The leader added that there are many problems to address, but the government can well overcome them by tapping into Iran's vast national potential. Iran's new president Ebrahim Raisi has vowed to rebuild public trust and to bridge the gap between the government and people during his tenure.
What has caused the most problems, in addition to the harm inflicted to people's livelihoods and businesses, is the damage to public trust. People sought a government to repair this damage, to restore their trust and narrow the gap with the government. A good relationship between the government and people can resolve problems.
Raisi made the comments after he was confirmed as Iran's 8th president. He said the Iranian nation demanded change, justice, and an end to corruption through their vote in the June 18 presidential election. He added that change is necessary and inevitable, and that his government plans to make it happen. Raisi called on the elites, officials, and people to play their part and to help bring about that change. The 61-year-old president also noted that he would certainly try to get U.S. sanctions removed, but would not tie people's livelihoods and the economy to that aim. Fuad Izadi is a university professor and political analyst who joins us. We also have Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, a journalist and political commentator who joins us from London. Okay, welcome to you both. Fuad Izadi, let me first start with you. Obviously, an air of optimism is prevailing here, and the speech that Sayyid Ebrahim Raisi made just proves the point that he, in terms of the economy, for example, went into the details, had figures that he was citing of how things need to be improved, like the deficit, like obviously inflation, unemployment, things of that nature. Domestically speaking, how did you view his speech and how do you see him moving forward on that front?
Obviously, he has lots of difficulties managing a country of over 80 million. Running a government is not easy, not in Iran and not elsewhere. He has a number of people that are going to help him that have lots of experience. As you know, he spent all his life, his adult life, in the judiciary section of the Iranian government, in the judiciary branch. And so he doesn't have any experience in the executive branch. He's going to rely on advisors and the ministers that he's going to appoint to move forward the plans that he talked about today. So the task is huge. And the capabilities are also substantial. And given the fact that he's not going to have tensions with other branches of government, there's going to be a unity of worldview when it comes to what Iran's domestic and foreign policy should be. I think that lack of tension and lack of disagreements within the government is going to help him move his agenda forward.
Well, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, on the foreign policy front, how do you see Ebrahim Raisi executing himself? One of the things that was really standing out in his speech today was the fact that he said that he will do what he can to remove these tyrannical, as he said, sanctions that have been imposed on the country. So that obviously puts the U.S. right front and center. when it comes to the sanctions and obviously the JCPOA. How do you see him functioning in that respect?
I think that there won't be any radical changes overnight in foreign policy, for sure. I think the foreign policy of the Islamic Republic of Iran is set by a much broader set of, if you like, thinkers and strategists. And it's been a very successful foreign policy, I would say. I think if we looked at the Islamic Republic of Iran's policies in its neighborhood, it's been of service and help. You only have to look at Iraq, which would be collapsing without the electricity and the economic support that Iran has provided it. Further afield, we're seeing that even with Saudi Arabia, which has aligned itself with the Zion-American interests in the region for decades, is beginning to make some positive noises. Can't totally be trusted, but the magnanimity of the Iranian establishment is that they are open to developing better relations in order to create regional stability. Now, that obviously is a very tall order, but I'm sure that Abu Raisi will pursue such diplomacy, and he's in fact said that he will. That can only augur well for, you know, the tensions that have been created largely by the Israeli balkanization of that region. I think that if we look to the east, well, Afghanistan is beginning to change. We don't know, it's a volatile region, but it's an important aspect for Iran's foreign policy. And there again, they're aiding the situation rather than inflaming it, as the Americans and others have done. So Iran's policy with its neighbors is a friendly one, and I think that that's going to continue. It's also not going to change in terms of the support of the resistance axis. Those oppressed nations, particularly Yemen, Syria, and Iraq, which are essentially either occupied or are being forced into occupation by, again, that bête noire of West Asia, the Zio-American, or what I call the Anglo-Zionist axis. So there, I think we're again going to see increased support of the resistance and the movement against oppression. And I certainly think there's going to be a very strong stand against any further Israeli aggression. And we're seeing that, you know, false flags are continuing. Only this week, the tanker that has been sabotaged. The Israelis, the United Kingdom, and the rest of the usual suspects are blaming Iran. So that's the challenge for Al-Raisi to manage this aggression. And of course, they've done it with the strength of the military. And I think these are the solid bases that Al-Raisi, in terms of foreign policy, can build on, because Iran hasn't been lackluster in terms of its development of technology, its development of its military capabilities, and its sort of a geostrategic maneuvers to protect its own sovereignty. So I see that there are many, many challenges. Clearly, it's going to be a huge effort to try and keep Israel from getting America and others to start wars, be they proxy wars through ISIS types, or be they through the asymmetric warfare or the cyber warfare, which we know is a continuous effort on their part. They will still continue to, of course, try color revolution. And Islamic Republic of Iran, especially in this period, has to be very vigilant, and no doubt will be, about the psychological operations, the intelligence operations, and the operations to upend the Islamic democracy that exists there in Iran. Many challenges, but I see a stronger, more forceful government.
Thank you for that, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator. Thank you, Fouad Azadi, university professor and political analyst. Moving on, Iran has warned of a crushing response to any threats against its national security after the U.S. and the U.K. accused Tehran of being behind a recent strike on an Israeli-managed vessel off Oman.
The United States and Britain have intensified their anti-Iran rhetoric over last week's deadly attack on an Israeli-managed oil tanker off the coast of Oman, without providing any substantial evidence. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken claimed that Washington is confident that Iran conducted the attack on the MT Mercer Street and vowed, quote, an appropriate response. British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab also said UK assessments had concluded that it was highly likely that Iran used one or more drones to carry out the attack which killed a Briton and a Romanian. Iran, which has rejected similar accusations from Israel over the attack, came down on top American and British diplomats.
Iran strongly regrets and condemns the baseless accusations made by the British Foreign Secretary against Iran, which were repeated by the U.S. Secretary of State in the same context and contained contradictory, false, and provocative accusations.
The accusations also drew a strong reaction from an informed source close to the Supreme National Security Council of Iran.
Iran considers the threats of Western officials and the Zionist regime to be more of a propaganda gesture. But any moves against Iran's interests and its national security will be met with a crushing and firm response, and Washington and London will be directly responsible for the consequences.
Earlier, resistance sources told Iran's Al-Alam Arabic News Network that the attack was in retaliation for a recent deadly Israeli airstrike on an airport in Syria's Qusair region. Astonishingly, Washington and London have thrown their weight behind Israel while they have produced no proof of Iran's involvement in the attack. However, they have turned a blind eye to Israel's hostile actions against Iran, including attacks on a dozen Iranian oil tankers, which was revealed in a report by the Wall Street Journal in March, and the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists. Above all, Israel's frequent attacks on Syria and the Gaza Strip, as well as its atrocities in the Palestinian territories, have been ignored by the international community. It seems that Britain and the U.S. have given Israel carte blanche to commit crimes with impunity. The West's unwavering support has emboldened Tel Aviv to push ahead with its crimes, but the attack on the Israeli managed ship and the regime's latest defeat in the war on Gaza at the hands of Palestinian resistance groups spotlighted the regime's weakness. It shows that the era of hit and run for Israel is coming to an end.
The Chinese city of Wuhan, where COVID-19 emerged for the first time, will test its entire population as the virus returns there. Authorities are saying that all 11 million residents will swiftly be tested. On Monday, the city logged 7 COVID infections among migrant workers. They were the first local cases that were identified in more than a year after Wuhan brought its outbreak under control. Other Chinese cities have also rolled out mass testing as an outbreak of the Delta variant quickly spreads. People in affected areas have been confined to their homes also. On Tuesday, China reported 61 domestic infections. The number of confirmed COVID-19 cases in the U.S. has surpassed the grim milestone of 35 million. According to Johns Hopkins University tally, more than 613,000 people have also died from the disease. California has become the first state to top 4 million cases. Florida, where the governor has made mask and vaccination mandatory, also witnessed one of the worst outbreaks, accounting for about a quarter of the country's COVID hospitalization cases. Meanwhile, Democrats are piling fresh pressure on the White House to renew a pandemic-related residential eviction moratorium after lawmakers failed to extend the ban before its expiry at the weekend.
We want Biden to pin, an eviction moratorium and getting that executive order done, but we're not just leaving it on the White House. We're asking for Congress. We're asking House leadership to reconvene us, bring us back. Bring us back because this is our job. We can't go on recess. We can't go on vacation when millions of people's lives are at risk.
Earlier, U.S. House Democrats called on the administration of President Joe Biden to immediately extend a nationwide ban on housing evictions that expired on Saturday. Biden had asked Congress to extend the deadline on Thursday amid a surging Delta variant. But Congress failed to act after Republican House members blocked a Democratic-led bid. The House has already left for a 6-week summer recess, and it remains unclear whether the administration could extend the moratorium using executive powers. Over 15 million Americans face evictions as they are currently behind on their rental payments amid COVID restrictions. A Washington correspondent, Colin Campbell, says the U.S. continues to struggle with the pandemic, probably due to the reluctance of some people to get vaccinated or to follow health protocols.
We're now again in a dire situation where we're seeing an uptick in the number of COVID cases rising in several states across the country, including, like you said, California, and of course in Florida, where the governor there, Ron DeSantis, has had some relaxed policies in dealing with COVID-19. So right now, the U.S. is in a mode to recalibrate. We're going to see just how we move forward. There are a number of vaccines that have sat on shelves in bottles unused, and it's estimated that we've wasted about 1 million doses of vaccine. Can you imagine that? There are a number of millions of Americans who don't want to get vaccinated. There are millions of people around the world who do want to get vaccinated. And here we have millions of doses of vaccine just rotting away on our shelves. It's really a confounding situation that we find ourselves in here in the United States, as we want things to get back to normal, but there are different people have different approaches in how they want to see things get back to normal. There's some people who think that they wish away the disease, they wish away the virus, they ignore it exists, and therefore things will be back to normal because everything is just being propagated by media. Then there are those who believe in the science, who say, listen, this is a very serious threat. We have to take it seriously. We have to be deliberative about trying to avoid each other. If we believe we have the COVID virus, we have to wear masks, we have to get vaccinated, and that's how we get back to normal. And right now, it seems that we're on parallel paths as we struggle as a country to get back to a level of normalcy as we see COVID cases rising across the nation.
Tunisian President Kais Saied has dismissed two more ministers as the political crisis continues in the Arab country. Kais Saied relieved both finance minister as well as technologies minister, who was also holding the agriculture portfolio. The president has now replaced them with new ministers. Saied had previously dismissed the defense minister just one day after firing the country's prime minister and suspending parliament. The moves sparked widespread protests. However, the president defended his actions, saying that he acted within the constitution. In Turkey, firefighters are still struggling to contain wildfires raging through southern coastal resorts for about 6 days. Firefighters backed by planes and helicopters and locals with buckets of water are now battling the blazes. Huge flames could be seen engulfing trees in Marmaris and Manav Ghat. Officials say that seven fires are still burning, fanned by temperatures above 40 degrees Celsius, strong winds, and low humidity. According to meteorological authorities, the heat wave exacerbated the fires after months of exceptionally dry weather in Turkey's southwest. The government is under severe criticism over its handling of the disaster. And that is for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید. ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Imam Khomeini was a religious scholar and a true worshipper and servant of God. If you remember the previous episode, it was said that Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, was very hateful of doing mustahab or recommended acts, although they're not religiously obligatory. He also said that he was very careful not to do makruh or disapproved acts, the acts that are not haram or forbidden but have been emphasized to refrain from. Today we are going to continue the discussion. Nafile in Arabic means additional. According to the Islamic jurisprudence, it means the daily prayers that are not obligatory and just recommended. These prayers have a lot of reward. There are 34 rak'at of recommended prayers, which are performed with daily ritual obligatory ones. But on Friday, 4 rak'at are added to this number. These prayers are highly emphasized to recite as God will give ample rewards for them. However, the midnight prayer is the most important recommended prayer and has a lot of effects in both material and spiritual aspects of human life. According to the statements of the Prophet and the infallible Imams, recommended prayers somehow compensate for the shortcomings of obligatory ones. Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, says in this regard, "Indeed, we have been ordered to perform recommended prayers in order to compensate for the defects of obligatory prayers." Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, also says, "God said, 'Indeed, my servant seeks proximity to me by recommended prayer and deeds, and once I like him, I will be his ear that he hears with it, his eye that sees with it, and his tongue that speaks with it.'" Hujjat al-Islam Rasuli Mahallati said, "As far as I remember and I have heard from the relatives and companions of Imam Khomeini, he would not give up performing recommended prayers as much as he could." Dear listeners, Imam Khomeini didn't give up performing recommended prayers even when the security forces of the Pahlavi regime, Savak, intruded into his house. Late Ayatollah Tawassuli also mentioned an interesting memory. In the evening of the day in which the tragedy of Fazia school happened, we were at the Imam's home. We heard that the seminary students had been beaten and the regime forces intended to come there. Late, Sayyid Muhammad Sadiq stood up and closed the door of the house. But Imam Khomeini immediately stood up and opened the door, saying, "Shall I close the door of my house while they are beating my children?" Then he stood up for prayer and, like other nights, performed midnight prayer while every moment his house would likely be attacked. Dear friends, Imam Khomeini would not leave performing of recommended prayers even at the times that he was exhausted. Late Ayatollah Bani Fazil related a memory on this. In the first days after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Qom, Imam Khomeini had public meetings from 8:30 a.m. till midday, during which he would deliver detailed speeches. So he had to go upstairs to the roof several times. One day, a few minutes before noon, the imam's face was very tired as he was going into the room. I said to myself that this time he would have a rest, but when I followed him, I saw him performing recommended prayer of midday obligatory prayer. Imam Khomeini would observe little points even in recommended prayers. For instance, he would not forget saying, "A'udhu billahi minash shaitani rajim," which means, "I seek refuge with God from the outcast Satan." Imam's companions also say that he used to recite Surah Tawhid in both his obligatory and recommended prayers, although it can be dropped in recommended ones. Imam Khomeini would not give up performing of recommended prayers even in hot summer. Ayatollah Qadiri says, "In the blessed month of Ramadan, when the Imam would come to the school of late Ayatollah Borujerdi in Najaf for midday and afternoon prayers, he used to first perform the 8 rak'at recommended prayers of midday prayer and then perform the midday prayer itself. This was not an easy job for a fasting person of that age and in such a hot weather. Even the youth would fail to do it, but the imam was so serious in worships." Hujjat al-Islam Sayyid Mujtaba Rudbari relates a memory. "In such an old age, and during the hot days of Ramadan in Najaf, Imam Khomeini would observe the recommended prayers of Maghrib or Dusk and Isha, that is night obligatory prayers, whereas we as young people were expecting to finish prayer to go to iftar for breaking the fast." This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio. The Spotlight.
The United States and the United Kingdom have joined Israel in accusing Iran of the attack on an Israeli tanker off the coast of Oman. Iran has vehemently denied any involvement in the attack, dismissing allegations leveled by the Israeli regime officials, including from the U.S. and the U.K. Furthermore, an informed Iranian source says that the country will give a strong and crushing response to any measure taken against the Islamic Republic's interests and security. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the possibilities of a military confrontation, whether this is an Israeli plot aimed to demonize and vilify Iran.
The United States and Britain have intensified their anti-Iran rhetoric over last week's deadly attack on an Israeli-managed oil tanker off the coast of Oman without providing any substantial evidence. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken claimed that Washington is confident that Iran conducted the attack on the MT Mercer Street and vowed, quote, an appropriate response. British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab also said UK assessments had concluded that it was highly likely that Iran used one or more drones to carry out the attack which killed a Briton and a Romanian. Iran, which has rejected similar accusations from Israel over the attack, came down on top American and British diplomats.
Iran strongly regrets and condemns the baseless accusations made by the British Foreign Secretary against Iran, which were repeated by the U.S. Secretary of State in the same context and contained contradictory, false, and provocative accusations.
The accusations also drew a strong reaction from an informed source close to the Supreme National Security Council of Iran.
Iran considers the threats of Western officials and the Zionist regime to be more of a propaganda gesture. But any moves against Iran's interests and its national security will be met with a crushing and firm response, and Washington and London will be directly responsible for the consequences.
Earlier, resistance sources told Iran's Al Alam Arabic News Network that the attack was in retaliation for a recent deadly Israeli airstrike on an airport in Syria's Qusayr region. Astonishingly, Washington and London have thrown their weight behind Israel while they have produced no proof of Iran's involvement in the attack. However, they have turned a blind eye to Israel's hostile actions against Iran, including attacks on a dozen Iranian oil tankers, which was revealed in a report by the Wall Street Journal in March, and the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists. Above all, Israel's frequent attacks on Syria and the Gaza Strip, as well as its atrocities in the Palestinian territories, have been ignored by the international community. It seems that Britain and the U.S. have given Israel carte blanche to commit crimes with impunity. The West's unwavering support has emboldened Tel Aviv to push ahead with its crimes, but the attack on the Israeli-managed ship and the regime's latest defeat in the war on Gaza at the hands of Palestinian resistance groups spotlighted the regime's weakness. It shows that the era of hit and run for Israel is coming to an end.
Well, our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, we have publisher and editor at Politics First, Marcus Papadopoulos, who joins us from London. We also have political analyst John Busnich, who joins us from Podgorica. Okay, let me first go to you, Marcus Papadopoulos. We're looking at the fact that Iran has vehemently denied the accusations that's been leveled against it, dismissing what the Israel regime has said regarding that attack on the vessel. The Iranian foreign minister has called the accusations childish, one of the words that he used, which he said were influenced by the Zionist lobby in the U.S. What is your take on the way that Iran is being barraged by these false accusations, as it is deemed, coming from Israel and then the U.K. and the U.S.?
Well, I will say this first of all, that in accounting for why, in terms of conflict, the Middle East is the most volcanic part of the world, one must take into consideration, indeed, it is absolutely imperative for one to take into consideration the very real fact that Israel has a flagrant disregard and contempt for the sovereignty of neighboring countries such as Syria and Lebanon and also Iran. In the case of Syria and Lebanon, Israel on a regular basis violates the airspace and maritime waters of Syria and Lebanon. And in the case of Syria, Israel has supported terrorist forces during the Syrian conflict, most notably Al-Qaeda, as evidenced by how Israeli hospitals treated wounded Al-Qaeda fighters. And those wounded Al-Qaeda fighters were greeted by Benjamin Netanyahu on television. So when we have a look today at how Iran is being demonized, which they are being demonized, it is little surprise because ever since the Iranian Revolution of 1979, Iran has been targeted, not just by America and Britain, but also Israel. Why? Because Iran is of immense geostrategic importance, and Israel regards Iran as being the linchpin constituting resistance to Israeli aggression in the Middle East.
Okay.
And therefore, it is in the interests of Israel to try and provoke a conflict between principally America and Iran.
All right. Well, John Bosner, let's take a look at what Israel has said regarding this. I'm going to go to the Premier, Naftali Bennett, who was accused Tehran of this. And he says, quote, "I declare unequivocally that Iran is the one that carried out the attack on the ship." He said that during a weekly meeting of his cabinet on Sunday. Why is it that when Israel comes out making accusations, it doesn't provide the proof?
Because it's not asked to provide the proof. You know, we have a media system dominated by pro-Israeli forces in the United States and in most of the Western world. And that results in a very biased picture of events. So we have people automatically saying that Israel is the victim, that Iran is the perpetrator, regardless of whether there is any evidence.
Let's take a look at the U.S. statement coming after what Israel has said. Marcus and Secretary of State Anthony Blinken has said that that upon review of the available information, we are confident that Iran conducted this attack, which killed two innocent people, using one-way explosive UAVs. And he said that there will be retaliatory action coming. Did that take you by surprise that the U.S. was so quick to come out, aside from accusing Iran, saying that there's going to be a retaliatory reaction or attack coming from the U.S.?
No, that statement came as no surprise to me whatsoever. Firstly, Israel is the crucial conduit for American power in the Middle East. Where would America's supremacy of the Middle East be without Israel? Secondly, since when has the American government corroborated serious allegations against another government with evidence which would be held up in a legitimate court of law? The answer is rarely, if ever. The Americans never supplied evidence, concrete evidence, that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, or that Colonel Gaddafi was intent on slaughtering the entire civilian population of Benghazi, or that the Syrian government was intent on massacring its own people. The American government makes these baseless allegations against the Syrian government, or in this case, the Iranian government, because the American government knows that its allegation will not come under scrutiny by American mainstream media. Why? Because American mainstream media is neither free nor independent. It is controlled by the American establishment. If America had a free press, indeed, if Britain had a free press, then I do not believe that American politicians or British politicians would be so confident in airing in public their allegations against Iran, because they know that their allegations would be taken apart by journalists who are most robust in their work and who are diligent journalists. So the Americans know very well, as the British know, they can make any allegation against any government in the world which pursues an independent foreign policy without an ounce of evidence, because the media in their respective countries are neither free nor independent.
Mm-hmm. Well, John Bosnich, this is where it gets a little bit confusing in so many words about this reaction to come. The U.S. Has said that it's going to that has vowed what it calls an appropriate response is the words that Anthony Blinken used. Now, why does it get confusing? Well, you have the U.K. also adding to that support of a response to come, but then based on an Israeli newspaper, Kan, by the name of Kan, K-A-N, it reported that Tel Aviv has received a green light from Washington and London to carry out a response to the attack. So does that mean that U.S. and the U.K. are not going to have a response, but rather Israel will take care of that, or that there's one to come cumulatively? How do you see these particular stances coming?
This is kind of a case like a dog chasing its own tail. You might have heard of the movie Wag the Dog. What happens here is the Israel lobby in the political systems, in the democratic political systems of England and the United States, is the single largest contributor to the extremely expensive political campaigns of both the government and the opposition. John Mearsheimer wrote a book called The Israel Lobby recently while I was working in Washington, and he stated clearly and showed the statistics that 60% of the funding for the Democratic Party came from supporters of the Israel lobby, and 40% of the funding for the Republican Party came from the same source. So the signal comes from the lobbyists who pay the politicians to say what they need said. And unfortunately, this is a terrible, terrible attack on democracy. It results in the politicians doing what they're told by the people who paid their campaigns to keep them in office. That means Israel calls the politicians that it puts in office to declare that what Israel says is the truth. The truth is then, so-called truth in big quotation marks, is then replicated through the what President Trump himself called the lying mainstream media, who then propagate it down to the local level across the entire country. So anybody in America who still trusts the mainstream media of America has been asleep for at least the past 4 to 5 years. And what is worse about this is that it allows Israel to place America and England in a situation where they are in a checkmate position, that if they do not back Israel up, if they do not back Israel up, they find themselves losing their seats in Parliament and losing their seats in Congress. So Israel pulls all the strings, and this is a very, very dangerous situation, not just for Iran, but a dangerous situation for anybody targeted by that same lobby.
Marcus Papadopoulos, what's interesting about this report that I just mentioned coming from that newspaper of all places is the fact that it adds to the information that Israeli regime officials are currently discussing how and when to respond. And it says with possibilities that an Iranian port or a military ship could be targeted. I mean, we know from Israel, at least based on its record, that it's not going to discuss how it's going to conduct any type of action. I mean, we know that, for example, how it assassinated top Iranian nuclear scientist Fakhrizadeh. Now, of course, Iran has said, and I have to say this, according to informed sources, that it will give a strong and crushing response to any measure taken against its national interest and security, which it has blamed Britain, the U.S., and Israel for the consequences. Do you think that there's going to be this reaction coming, one that's being mulled over at this point by Israel, according to this particular report, the possibilities of an Iranian port or military ship to be the targets?
I do not believe that Israel will take a conventional response against Iran. And I think it is even more unlikely that America and Britain will take a conventional response against Iran. However, I do strongly suspect, in fact, I strongly believe, that Israel's response, its measures, will be of a clandestine nature, such as an assassination of a high-ranking Iranian official or a senior Iranian scientist, or indeed the destruction of an Iranian port or the destruction of an Iranian naval vessel. That, I do believe, is highly likely to be the response of Israel. When will the Israelis carry out such a measure? Well, it could be in the short term, it could be in the long term. And if Israel does resort to such a measure, which, as I said at the beginning of the show, would demonstrate again Israel's flagrant disregard and contempt for the concept of state sovereignty, that would provide the Iranian government with a legal recourse to take action against Israel. I do not wish to see any conflict in the Middle East. How many people, innocent people, men, women, and children, have perished in the Middle East because of needless wars over decades now? However, Iran has a right to defend itself. Iran has a right to national security. If the Americans and the British and the Israelis have concrete, persuasive evidence to corroborate their assertion that the Iranian government was responsible for the attack on this Israeli-owned vessel, then they should announce it at the United Nations, and the United Nations Security Council should be allowed to study the evidence. However, the Americans and the British and the Israelis have not done that so far, and they are not going to do that. The whole point here is that Iran is a target of Washington, London, and Tel Aviv, and therein lies my concern that an escalation in this matter is possible, because Iran has a right to defend itself.
John Bosnich, do you think that that's a road that we're heading down with this?
Most regrettably, yes, I do. I agree with every word once again that my fellow commentator has said today. And I think that this is a good time to remember history, because we are now just a few years after 100 years from the First World War. And the key words we were taught in school about the First World War was that the stupidest thing that any country could ever do is to give a carte blanche, in other words, a blank signed check, to another country. And what has happened now is the United States and England have given a blank signed check to Israel in any amount. And Israel now has the opportunity to do whatever it wants. And as soon as it takes that action, in effect, it's taking an action on behalf of the American people and on behalf of the people of Great Britain without any democratic input, because the legislators, without voting on it, have given Israel the right to make war at will. And Iran is just one of the targets of this kind of a completely crazy repeat of what led directly to World War I.
Marcus Papadopoulos, if Israel was to take any action, or any, whether U.S. or U.K., were to take any action against Iran, Iran has said, and I repeat, that it's going to take, it's going to obviously value any measure against its interests and national security will be met with strong and crushing response. I mentioned the quote from Iran coming on this. Don't you think that that will definitely affect the calculations that the U.S. has made in terms of trying not to have the West Asia region in its focus, but rather to go and pursue what it has in regards to China and that area?
There's no doubt about it whatsoever. Washington seeks the destruction of the Iranian revolution to return Iran to how it was under the Shah, namely a Western client state. But I do not believe that America seeks a war with Iran, because America recognizes that the Iranian revolution has given birth to a very strong economy in Iran, a very strong military in Iran, and has brought about a great deal of unity in Iran. And the Americans understand that a military conflict between America and Iran would result in a bloodshed and would destabilize American interests in the Middle East, principally on the Arabian Peninsula. However, I am of the opinion that Israel would very much like to see America and possibly Britain embroiled in a conflict with Iran. And again, I say this: Iran has a right to defend itself. Why is it that Israel can violate the sovereignty of Lebanon and Syria? Why is it that Israel can harass and torment and massacre Palestinians, including women and children, on a regular basis, but is never pulled before a court of law? Why is it that Israel can support Al-Qaeda in Syria, and yet when it comes to Iran, Iran is expected by the Americans and the British and the Israelis to be subservient to Western demands?
Sure. Let me address those questions to John Bosnich there in conclusion. Go ahead.
Well, this is a most dangerous situation. There is zero accountability now for whatever action Israel wants to take. Israel set this situation up. Israel bought its legislators in America and in England. Israel has the weapons supplied to it by foreign countries as foreign aid. And Israel now has the right to make any kind of illegal war crime attack on Iran at any time. And this tells us that not just Israel, but those who control the United States and those who control England have zero respect for international law and have zero respect for the concept itself of justice. Because if you believe in justice, then you know that justice takes time and it takes investigation to find the truth. And the reason why all of these things are rushed the way they are is because when you rush it and you make an attack and you make a murderous bombing, you can get away with it before they can respond. And afterwards, all it is an autopsy, a political autopsy of the Western world.
All right, we're going to unfortunately have to end it there. We're fresh out of time on this. Let me thank our guests, publisher and editor at Politics First, Marcus Papadopoulos. Thank you so much for your comments. And John Bosnich there, political analyst, with his comments. And with that, we come
to an end
for this edition of The Spotlight. From me, Kobe Tak, my entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Thank you. universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: صاحب السلطان كراكب الأسد، يغبط بموقعه وهو أعلم بموضعه.
Imam Ali stated, "The holder of authority is like the rider on a lion. He is envied for his position, but he well knows his position." Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, the son of Abu Talib alayhi salam. One of the beautiful lessons which we learn from the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is this idea of being devoted to our salah, our prayers, our namaz, our worship of Allah. Now, it is well known and it has been documented in the history books and the books of traditions that Imam Ali alayhi salam was devoted to the nightly supplications. Now, here the nightly supplications are found to be both the Salatul Layl, the midnight supererogatory prayers, as well as du'as and litanies and supplications which were recited by Imam Ali alayhi salam in the night. Now, of course, Imam Ali alayhi salam being devoted to these nightly prayers, these midnight prayers, these du'as, these supplications and these litanies, and this remembrance and dhikr of Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, in the middle of the night, is something which is well known. And so, dear friends, we should also try to, whatever extent we can, to perform either these midnight prayers or to perform these du'as, these supplications, in the middle of the night. Now, why is the middle of the night so emphasized? It is actually a very difficult thing for the average person to wake up in the middle of the night, leave the comfortable bed, the warm bed, and get up and do the remembrance, the dhikr of Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, to do prayers, to do